Standing on the ridge overlooking her coastal California farm, Terry McCall sees her late husband Jack nearly everywhere. There, atop the highest hill, is where the couple married in 1975. Two self-described hippies who knew more about how to surf than farm. Midway up the hill, on a lush plateau surrounded by the lemons, avocado, and orange trees that Jack planted, sits the 800-square-foot house the then-young Vietnam War veteran built for his bride and a family that grew to include two sons and a daughter. One of those sons now lives there with his own wife and small son. Solar panels Jack set up in a sun-drenched stretch of grass help power the farm's irrigation system. Down there, nestled in a velvety green valley, is a century-old farmhouse Jack and Terry made their home after Jack's parents died. The two-story white Victorian boasts a front porch wide enough for rocking chairs and potted flowers and for friends to gather. Jack and Terry spent countless quiet nights on that porch, watching stars light up the sky, which is always so dark out here in the countryside. Over the front door is a stained glass window Jack installed that features a heart and flowers. Inside, a plaque etched with the word "Blessed" hangs over the bedroom door. Terry was only 17 when she met 23-year-old Jack just after he returned from Vietnam. He had been a first lieutenant in the 101st Airborne Division and received both a Bronze Star and a Distinguished Flying Cross for his service. When Terry saw him, though, he didn't look like a soldier, but more like a big kid, laughing and playing frisbee with friends. She remembers being almost instantly smitten by his rugged good looks and easy smile. It took 5 years before they became more than friends, and then 40 years passed all too quickly. Literally hundreds of times a day, something reminds me of him, McCall tells me, as I stand beside her on the ridge one bright spring morning a few months after Jack's death. Her tears start to flow. That's part of why it's so hard to believe, to know that even if I search the whole world, look everywhere, I can't find him now. She shakes her head. So hard to believe I can never see him again. Anthony Jack McCall, age 69, died on December 26, 2015, after a painful and perplexing battle with an aggressive form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a type of cancer that forms in the lymphatic system and can appear almost anywhere in the body. The loss is certain, fixed forever in his family's heartbreak. But questions about why and how he was stricken, a man who never smoked, who stayed fit, and who had no history of cancer in his family, swirl around his use of the popular weed killer Roundup and its active ingredient glyphosate. McCall shunned pesticide use on his farm except for Roundup. He didn't like the idea of synthetic chemicals floating around the orchard where he grew apricots, peaches, plums, and apples, or near his precious avocados. But Roundup was marketed as having extremely low toxicity, nothing that a small farmer like Jack needed to worry about. He would drive 20 to 30 miles from his farm, just outside the seaside village of Cambria, to Morrow Bay, or often into San Luis Obispo to buy his favorite weed killer. He would then apply it himself, spraying the pesticide all around the farm to beat back worrisome weeds. He even recommended Roundup to friends in the small Cambria community, telling them it was supposed to be much safer than alternatives and touting its effectiveness. But the death of McCall and the illnesses and deaths of other farmers and glyphosate users like him have come amid revelations of a number of hidden dangers associated with the chemical, including links to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And what began as a trickle of worry has widened into a flood of outrage against Monsanto and the regulators who have deemed glyphosate safe. Soon after her husband's death, McCall's widow, Terry, joined a movement of thousands of people who are bringing wrongful death lawsuits against Monsanto. People from around the United States who claim that Roundup can cause cancer and that Monsanto has tried to cover up the risks. It's been nearly 20 years since I first walked into the corporate headquarters of Monsanto Company, a visit that would become one of many over the course of my career as a national correspondent for Reuters, one of the oldest and largest news agencies in the world. Meeting with top executives, scientists, and marketing experts at Monsanto, perhaps the world's best-known agricultural powerhouse, was part of a job that called on me to help keep international audiences informed about the ins and outs and evolutions of agriculture in the United States. The types of seeds farmers plant in their fields and the chemicals they use to treat their crops are big business, amounting to billions of dollars in revenues for Monsanto and the other companies that sell them. But the fundamentals of growing food ultimately have much larger implications. Not only do farmers' choices influence commodity pricing and trade relationships, but they also ultimately affect the health and well-being of all of us. The food we eat, the water we drink, the landscape of our environment all are connected to these seemingly simple choices made by farmers in their fields. Before my 1998 move to the farm state of Kansas to write about agriculture for Reuters, I spent a good deal of my journalism career delving into the financial wheeling and dealing of the big banking, commercial real estate, and insurance industries. I also spent a fair share of my time chasing chaos. I covered the death and devastation wrought by Hurricane Katrina, floods, fires, and droughts, and the constant tornadoes that roared across rural America. And I was dispatched to duck bullets, bricks, and bottles in the race-torn riots of Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. When assigned to cover the ag beat, I was at first a bit reluctant. I was skeptical that it could bring the intrigue and excitement I had experienced with the prior work I had done, and I had a lot to learn. My education in food production and farming meant not just sitting down with executives at companies like Monsanto and its rivals Dow and DuPont, but also listening to and studying the work of agricultural economists, soil and plant scientists, experts on seed germplasm, and of course farmers. My favorite times as an ag journalist have been spent in blue jeans and mud boots, traipsing through higher-than-my-head corn stalks with farmers and riding inside the cabs of combines alongside the hard-working, often tough-talking men and women who understand better than anyone the risks and rewards of modern food production. I have immense respect and gratitude for these farmers who devote their lives to toiling in unforgiving fields where the harvest bounty often depends on the whims of Mother Nature and the bulk of the profits go to deep pockets much higher up in the food chain. And I stand a bit in awe of the scientists who spend their careers studying how to do more with less, how to grow enough food for an expanding world population in ways that could not even have been imagined a generation ago.